The main point is when you have two potentials, and so you have two Schrödinger equations, you have that the set of Cauchy data is the same. So let me summarize what we did, is that you have this relation is equal to zero. So the products or solutions of different Schrödinger equations, there's a single semanas here, is orthogonal to the difference of the solutions. And by constructing solutions, special solutions, which are these, they call complex geometrical optics or complex exponentials, and this goes to zero for large complex frequencies. So rho I here again are complex frequencies. The relation we could show that in fact we can recover the Fourier transform in dimension bigger or equal than 3. That's a summary of what we did. So let me point out just very briefly that if it's not zero, I mean you don't have that these two are equal, and you want to reconstruct, you take the potential you want to reconstruct, take Q2 to be zero, and the right-hand side won't be zero anymore, but will be something given. And then you reconstruct the Fourier transform from this procedure. So the proof is robust, doesn't just give uniqueness, but also gives reconstruction and estimates. If these are not equal, you will have some relation here, and then you can estimate the difference of the potentials in terms of the given data. Okay, so today what I'm going to do is apply this type of techniques to inverse scattering by a potential. So it's a different inverse problem, but very much related. And this will be at a fixed energy. And I think Joel talked about inverse scattering a little bit at the beginning. Okay, so let me look at the stationary approach, which is really more convenient when you have fixed energy. The scattering. So the situation is the following. You have a potential, which I will assume is a bounded potential, and for simplicity will be compactly supported outside some bond. So you have some potential here, Q of x. And what you do here is you send plane waves to the potential, and you measure what happens. And from this scattering information, you would like to recover the potential. These are the internal forces. So mathematically, notice I changed the sign of the potential. One does the following. One solves this equation. I will explain a little bit. So here, omega is a unit vector in the sphere. The length is 1. That has the following asymptotic behavior. So this is looks like an eigenfunction, but it's not going to be an eigenfunction. It's a plane wave. So this is x dot omega. There is an amplitude times a spherical wave. And then some lower order term. So here, zeta is x over modulo of x. So let me explain a little. This requires some explanation. Okay, so this is the plane wave that I took at the beginning. So e to the I lambda x omega is a plane wave because this is constant where x dot omega is constant. Okay. Has the same value when x dot omega is equal to constant. So it's lambda is the frequency. So this is the direction of the plane wave. And this satisfies Manus Laplacian. I hope I get the sign right. It's lambda squared times e to the I lambda x times omega. Did I get it right? Yeah, Manus Laplacian is a positive operator. So this is not an eigenfunction, but a generalized eigenfunction. It's not in L2, so you cannot say it's an eigenfunction. Right? So what this is saying, that I can find generalized eigenfunctions of the perturbation that behave like these plane waves, plus an amplitude times a spherical wave. So out of here comes a spherical wave with a certain amplitude plus terms that decay very fast at infinity. Okay, so that's the... Actually, this requires a proof. To prove that there exists this eigenfunction, this is the direct problem. And I have, anybody who wants to see how to do this, I taught a course on scattering some while ago. I have extensive notes, detailed notes with all the proofs of this. It's not completely trivial to prove this, that these generalized eigenfunctions exist. So AQ, lambda theta omega, is called the scattering amplitude. Is the amplitude of this spherical wave, and the inverse scattering problem. So this is what we have from before, and this is measuring what happens to the wave after interact with the potential. So this is measures the amplitude of a spherical wave measured in direction theta, which is x over x. So, okay. So the inverse scattering problem is, suppose you measure this, can you recover the potential q? Right? So, there are many versions of this problem. First of all, and in one dimension, by the way, I don't know whether... did you talk about the one-dimensional problem or in general? Did you make this approach? Was this approach? Okay. In one dimension, this corresponds to what's called the reflection coefficient. So... So there are several versions. First of all, suppose you measure for all lambda, theta, omega. Okay? This is just too much information, and this has been known for a while. This is dimension, see, this is n minus 1 dimension. This is n minus 1. And you have one frequency, so that was assumed to be positive. So this is 2n minus 1. This is always bigger or equal than n, in dimension bigger or equal than 2. So it's always strictly bigger. It's always overdetermined in any dimension, highly overdetermined. And it has been known for a long time, since Born, although this was rigorously proved by Fayev, that the behavior of the scattering amplitude for large frequencies is like the Fourier transform of the potential, the direction theta minus omega, for large as lambda goes to infinity. So you know, for all, it's an easy exercise to show, you know, for all lambda, theta, and omega, then you can recover the potential Q. So this is called the Born approximation. But as I said before, this is just too much information. And we would like to restrict the set of information, and there are many possibilities depending on your interest. And one important one is the fixed frequency. That's the one I'm going to consider here. You fix lambda. So you're going to be measuring it for only one frequency. And the reason to do that is that many materials, for instance, the Q can represent the sound speed or things like that, depends on frequency. So if you fix it, then you don't have that problem. And so you just take it with one frequency, and you have to solve the problem with just that information. Okay? So this is what I'm going to look at. And the main... And this has been solved. So this has been solved for dimension bigger equal than 3, because one can show that if one knows this, and this is what I want to talk about, one can recover the Dirichlet-Neumann map of the set of Cauchy data for minus Laplacian plus Q minus lambda zero square and on a fixed ball out on a ball of radius. Remember, the potential has compact support. So here is your big ball. The potential is here. You're measuring scattering information for large x. So what I'm saying is, if you know this information, you can recover the set of Cauchy data here in this big ball. And this is something which is known to go from the far field. This is scattering amplitude. So you do scattering, you are making remote informations. It's very far away from the... In the corresponding scale from the internal forces. In the Dirichlet-Neumann map or the Cauchy data, you are close. From far field to near field. And this is the Cauchy data or Dirichlet-Neumann map. So, and this actually, the fact that from here you can do this was known for a long time. I think the farthest I have been is due to Bereshansky in the 50s. But at that time it was not known how to do this problem. Okay, so I want to explain how to do that in a sort of different way, how to go from the far field to the near field. And the important thing here, actually, for all of this is that the potential is known outside this ball. Okay? Remember, the potential is zero, in fact, here. And this, all of this works as long as you know the potential outside this big ball. Okay. So what's the... So let me assume you have two potentials. Only we'll talk about uniqueness again. All the other things can be done in a similar way. Let's assume you have two potentials, we have the same fixed energy scattering for all theta omega in the sphere. And again, it will be bigger or equal than 3. It's the same problem in dimension 2, that we don't know how to do this problem in dimension 2. We don't know how to recover Q from CQ in dimension 2. So these problems are in fact equivalent. And this is what I want to show. The fixed energy scattering and the Dirichlet-Neumann map are in fact equivalent problems. Okay. So remember, we have these generalized eigenfunctions. Apply to the side QI. Everything I'm going to integrate over the support of the. So I'm going to assume that the support of both potentials is contained in the ball of radius R. So remember, they are compactly supported. Guess what? The difference of the potentials is orthogonal to the theta here, x. Of course, this is a function of x. x omega dx is equal to 0. So let me explain how to prove this. So remember that before we had the product, the difference of the two potentials was orthogonal to all the solutions. Here we have to the products of these generalized eigenfunctions, which by the way are also called outgoing eigenfunctions. So let me indicate how to prove that. So let me write here the outgoing eigenfunction again for a general potential. I will leave it in the blackboard. So this solves and then has the asymptotic behavior for large x as a plane wave plus an amplitude and a spherical wave, and here so that it can be seen in the tape. I won't go to the other blackboard, plus this. Okay, so what's happening if you look at the difference of the two potentials, the two generalized eigenfunctions, keep writing x, theta is for the scattering amplitude, this satisfies the following equation. Is equal to 0 outside in the complement of the ball. Because, of course, the difference, this drops out, is the same for both, it's the same plane wave. This is the equation. The potentials are the same, it's the same plane wave for the. And then outside the ball, this is zero. So satisfies, this is called the reduced wave equation outside the ball. And also, because of this asymptotic behavior, this. Now I use the fact that the scattering amplitudes are the same. Right? This is the same for both. This is the same factor, this is the same factor. The difference is of this order, one order down. So this is the main order of behavior. So this is of order x minus n minus 1 over 2 minus 1. That here is where I have used the information that this is the same. And this is a famous lemma. It's called Rayleigh lemma. That says, if you have a solution of the reduced wave equation that behaves in this way, so this is one order faster of decay than expected, then it must be zero. So suppose you take, this is a general fact. Suppose you have a function which is equal to zero, and u behaves of this order at infinity. There is actually stronger versions of this in the L2 sense and things like this. This implies, so this is outside the ball, but in fact outside any compact set. This implies that u is in fact zero. Outside the ball. And I have a proof here. I can give it to anybody interested. It's just a two-page proof of this, this lemma. And it's a good exercise, actually, to try to do it yourself. It's not so complicated. I'm not going to do it here, but the implication of this is that these eigenfunctions are the same outside. So by Rayleigh lemma, these two eigenfunctions are the same, and this implies, therefore, by Green's theorem, these are the same away from the ball, of course. Then this is zero. Right? That's it's very simple. So it's a clear, at least, the outline. The outline is the scattering amplitudes are the same. Then the difference of the two outgoing eigenfunctions decays faster at infinity than expected, and therefore this is equal to zero outside by Rayleigh lemma outside the ball, and therefore by Green's theorem this is just zero for all the outgoing eigenfunctions. I can see from the faces that here maybe I'm not getting across too well.
Can you see this lemma one more time?
So, Rayleigh lemma?
Yeah, just...
Okay, this. So, you have a solution of this equation, right? Outside some ball. In fact, it's true outside any compact set. So, you have a solution of this equation that has this asymptotic behavior at infinity. For instance, in dimension 2, dimension 3, which is this is O of x to the 3 minus 1, is this must be minus 2. Then u must be 0 outside the ball. I recall that the Green's kernel from dimension 3, maybe this will help a little bit. The Green's kernel, the outgoing Green's kernel, so this is delta, in dimension 3, can be written explicitly as a constant, 1 over 4 pi, or something like this, over modulo of x. So the behavior is like 1 over modulo of x at infinity. And this is the behavior in general, the Green's kernel in general, is like modulo x to the n minus 1 over 2. Okay, but this resolves the question is equal to delta. So what it's saying is that you have a behavior faster at infinity than the Green's kernel, then it must be zero. Identically zero. Okay? It's a unique continuation type of result. Okay. So the next step.
The other part I
missed. Sorry?
There's the other part I didn't understand.
Oh, the other part.
So I mean, why the first one is zero? I mean, this is.
Okay. So this equation is true because. I promise I wouldn't erase this. It's true because this is a solution with the Q1 equal to psi. Is a Q1 times psi Q1. And then this is Q2 times psi Q2, and Q1 and Q2 are zero outside the ball. So they solve the standard reduced equation outside the ball. And because of this asymptotic behavior, it decays faster than the Green's kernel. By the way, it's a good calculation to compute the Green's kernel. It's not trivial in dimension bigger than 3. It's a Hankel function. It's a superposition. It's a good exercise, actually, to. It has a behavior, similar behavior to an exponential, but with a different decay here, but it's not the same. So it has a decay faster than the Green's kernel at infinity, then it must be identically zero. And in fact, one reduces it to computations related to the Green's kernel in the proof. I can give you the proof. It's not so complicated. So that's the proof that the. So the, in fact, it's a stronger statement that this is true. I mean, they are equal outside. So for integration by parts, here. Remember that this solves the same equation. Q1 times psi Q1 is equal to Laplacian psi Q1 minus lambda 0 squared. Right? It's the same trick that we did yesterday, except for this equation. This is Laplacian minus lambda 0 squared psi Q1. You integrate by parts, and the same truth for this. But the solutions are the same outside the ball. So therefore, all the data is zero. The data is the same for this and this. So therefore, this is just integration of the boundary of the ball, d mu psi q2 minus psi q1 times the Green's theorem. And these are all the same outside. So this is zero. I didn't prove several things here. I mean, I'm just making a general sketch of the proof. Yeah, this is actually what's considered to be an important problem in scattering, the fixed energy scattering problem. That's what I mentioned, but this is the same as the other problem. That's all what I want to point out. Okay. Is it more clear now? How about you three? Or four. Okay. I mean, again, there are some details here. The main detail, well, first of all, I did not explain this expansion. This takes a while. Second, I didn't prove Rayleigh's lemma, but except for these two things, is okay. So now, but we're not finished yet, because remember, to get our argument yesterday, we had to use these complex exponentials here. But here, these are real. They behave like real exponentials. And we cannot get that information directly from there. So the next lemma, and I will indicate the proof of this lemma. So take any, this is true for any potential. Take some L infinity potential which is supported in the ball of radius R. Then the set, consider this set. So lambda 0 is fixed. Lambda 0 is a fixed frequency. Consider the set of Hausdorff eigenfunctions where you're varying the angle. Remember, the angle is toward this position. You can send these plane waves in any possible direction. Consider this set, A, Q, lambda 0. These are, remember, these are solutions of the equation. This is dense in L2 of the ball, in fact in H2, in the space in N minus Laplacian plus Q minus lambda 0 square, which are the U's, all the U's, say in H1 or H2, whatever, where minus Laplacian plus Q equal to 0. In fact, H2, I only need the L2 part. So this means two derivatives in L2. Okay. So that means I take any solution of the equation, any solution of the equation, the Schrodinger equation minus lambda 0 square, and this is 1. And then we have a family here varying the angle. Can be approximated in the H2 sense by one of these Hausdorff eigenfunctions.
Too much information.
Right. So therefore, if this is true, assuming the lemma, we get that integral Q1 minus Q2 U1 U2 is equal to 0 for every solution. What? Because if we have it for the Hausdorff eigenfunctions here, you approximate every solution but the Hausdorff eigenfunctions, and then you get this. And therefore, now we use the argument that we had before. This implies, now we can use the complex exponentials. You see, the product of any solutions now is orthogonal to the difference of the potential, as before. So I will show you the idea of the proof of this. It's too much information, but it's one less than you had previously because you have fixed the frequency. Okay, so let me count information. Yes. Yes. Okay. If you are lost, I mean everybody's lost right here. No?
You've got the product of these two sides here.
Right.
Approximating each one by
By these ones.
You're using the size to approximate.
Right. So let me prove this. This statement, the last statement. Take U1 and U2, any two solutions of the Schrodinger equation. Right? So I can take side QI for a family of omegas, right? And let me call it omega alpha. Approximating, I have the other X omega, approximating the UI. This is a subsequence, a sequence. Okay? And then, and another one Well, it depends on the I, I guess. I equal 1 to 2. Yeah? And this is approximation is in the L2 sense. Right? That's all what we need for this argument. Right? Remember, this is dense varying the angle omega. So if you change this, then you can get any two solutions equal to 0. Yeah? Is that clear now? Sorry? In the H2, this is true in the H2 topology. I only need for this argument L2. But this argument is true for H2. In fact, that's a consequence of the L2 convergence by just some standard elliptic estimates. Okay? So how to prove this lemma, density lemma? Is it any other questions before we... go on. So how to prove the lemma, density, let me call it density lemma. So here still I will have to use some further things for scattering, but just to give you the sketch of proof. So suppose you have a function which is orthogonal to all the outgoing eigenfunctions. And this is a solution of the equation. So this is n is for the kernel of this operator. So f itself solves the equation. And it's in the corresponding space H2. Suppose you have this. So what I want to do I will change a little bit my notation because I will use an X in a moment. Let me call it Y. Okay. I want to prove F equal to 0. That's what we want to show. To show that the set is dense, we take something orthogonal to every element and we want to show that the F is 0. So I define the following function. Let me call it W of X equal to this F that we have times the outgoing Green's kernel. So this is the outgoing Green's kernel. So let me explain what this is. Remember the in dimension 3, in the case the potential is 0, the Green's kernel, in this case, is just c to the I lambda model of x or model of x. And it's a Hankin function in any dimension. It's the same thing. This is fixed. So it's a Green's kernel at x equal to y, so the pole is at y. And it satisfies the radiation condition at infinity. So ddr, so modulo of r, is a, let me indicate in dimension 3, because it's clearly here from the definition. So you take ddr, where r is modulo of x, gq lambda x y, Okay, so I want to fix the y. And you multiply, so you differentiate with respect to r. R is modulo of x. Here appears a modulo of x, right? When you take this, so 1 over r over this goes like O of r minus 1 as x goes to infinity. Okay? So it's the same property as the Green's kernel function satisfied. This is some form of the Sommerfeld radiation condition. There is some condition at infinity. Okay, so you have to impose some condition at infinity. Okay. So again, the construction of this Green's kernel has to be proven. It's all part of the scattering theory. For the direct problem, when you prove all of this, you have to develop this scattering theory, this Green's kernels, and so on and so forth, which I'm not going to do. I have extensive notes, anybody who wants to copy them. Okay. So I'm going to look at this outside the ball. So now, I take the behavior of this as x goes to infinity. Okay? So w of x is f of y. As x goes to infinity, this goes to the outgoing eigenfunction, omega y dy over the bound. Okay.
So what does this?
So w of x, this function that I define, this again has to be proven. The behavior of this, so this is the outgoing Green's kernel. As x goes to infinity, so I'm going to take this going to infinity, this behaves like the outgoing eigenfunction at the angle omega, where omega is x over modulo of x. Right? So I go in that direction. And this goes to the outgoing eigenfunction. Again, this is follows from the scattering theory that I did not develop. And it's actually part. The way you prove these outgoing eigenfunction expansions is by going through the Green's kernel and this type of arguments. And this is zero. Right? So it goes to zero at infinity and satisfies the equation Laplacian minus lambda zero squared W is equal to zero outside the ball. Right? Because the Green's kernel satisfies this equation outside the ball. Remember, the potential is supported on the ball. So this satisfies the equation, the reduced wave equation, has this asymptotic behavior at infinity, given in terms of the outgoing eigenfunctions. So by Rayleigh's lemma, and here I was imprecise about the exact behavior at infinity and so on and so forth, but this implies that W is equal to zero. And that's about. So this is identically zero outside the ball. Okay. I'm sorry that this I got into, perhaps I shouldn't have chosen this topic. I chose it because you told me to talk about inverse scattering, but I can see I'm using a lot of things that I did not prove. But what is the W? Yes?
I'm sorry, can I just go into, I know you're not supposed to give details, but
right.
Can you just go into a bit of detail as to how you passed that limit there?
Okay, this I did not prove, and I think I'm not in position to prove it here. It would take a while.
Oh, okay.
What I'm saying is you take this, because this is related to the definition itself of the outgoing eigenfunction. What I say, I take this function, okay, which is here I'm taking the outgoing Green's kernel. I let this x goes to infinity. This is the outgoing eigenfunction. That's a way to actually get the outgoing eigenfunction. as x goes to infinity. So you first have to develop what the Green's kernel is, the ongoing Green's kernel, and show that this in fact converges to this as x goes to infinity.
The way you guess is going right.
It's exactly that.
Comes from the Green function.
Exactly.
That's how you start. That's the only way you can guess. So you know that they come from the Green function.
This behavior, how do I prove this? I mean, this is. It's not a coincidence at all. I mean, this is the. How do I prove this? Yeah. By first constructing the Green's eigenfunction, this eigenfunction. And in fact, this side is exactly the behavior of the Green's kernel at infinity. That's why it's called outgoing eigenfunction. So you take this Green's kernel and look what happens as x. In this case, at x goes to infinity, and that's the outgoing eigenfunction. You can take that as your definition.
The Green function is, by definition, is this.
Right. This is this. It's a Green's kernel, right? This definition of a Green's kernel that satisfies some condition at infinity. The condition at infinity is really determined by what the Green's kernel is at the potential zero. Right? It's in terms of the in dimension 3 is determined by this behavior. In dimension higher than 3 is the Hankel function, some Hankel functions that you have. Okay. So this is not a surprise. I mean, this is not. It's in fact part of the development of the outgoing eigenfunction. Okay. By recall, so we have this function W is equal to zero outside the ball. It's identically zero outside the ball, but satisfies inside. I want to finish with this argument in a moment. Satisfies this. Equal to F, I'm sorry. Why? Because the definition minus Laplacian plus Q minus lambda 0 squared of W goes into here, right? But this is the delta of X minus Y. So it's the delta of X minus Y applied to F is F. Remember, I want to prove that F is 0. Right? So what now we have is the integral over the ball. I take F times, let me call this operator LW, which is F. Remember, I'm using my notation without the conjugates, right? L of W is F. What do I do now? Remember, I want to show that this is zero. I integrate by parts, right? This operator is L of F, W, in the ball. But L of F is zero because F was an element in the kernel of the Laplacian plus potential minus lambda zero squared, right? That was the, it's already erased. F was the solution itself of the equation, which was orthogonal to all the outgoing eigenfunctions. So this is zero. But plus the integration over the boundary, but the integration over the boundary involves the W. Right? Involves W times the derivative of F or whatever, times something, plus or minus the normal derivative times something, ds. Doesn't matter what the something is. But this is zero. This is zero because W is identically zero outside the ball. So this is zero. This implies that F is zero. That's the proof. Okay, so
the choice of psi of the outgoing are more natural in this case than the choice of this complex function.
Yes, exactly.
The Dirichlet phenomenon math.
Exactly.
Because they come from.
They come from physics.
Yeah, well, see, the other ones are a bit magic. Yeah?
Exactly. Yeah,
from Calderon's magic.
Yeah, from Calderon's magic, exactly. So a solution of this inverse scattering problem at fixed energy came from a completely unexpected direction. See, as Nassif is saying, the problem, the scattering problem, is for real waves. You know, you take real waves, e to the I lambda x omega, it's defined in terms of these real waves, and we solve the problem by taking this complex, which are not physical in some sense, waves, right? So, but a lot of things in mathematics are going go that way.
The scattering was known before?
Scattering, oh yeah, scattering has been known.
So maybe Calderon was...
Calderon did not know, about these things at all. In fact, Bereshansky's paper was discovered later. Some other people realized that one could do the inverse scattering at fixed energy by reducing it to the Dirichlet Neumann map, essentially, but it was in fact known from before, from scattering theory, from Bereshansky. This is not exactly the Bereshansky's proof, but it's but here I have used very heavily scattering theory. These outgoing Green's kernels, the outgoing eigenfunctions, all interrelated, but I hope it's believable that there is this connection between.
It's amazing how much PDE you can do with Liouville's theorem, because the
Rayleigh's theorem is a form of Liouville's theorem. Right, yeah. You have an equation that decays in a certain way at infinity, then it's zero.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too bounded, it has to be zero.
Right. So. And Liouville theorem come to play in many, many ways. I mean, it's also in what I told you in the two-dimensional case, the proof of the two-dimensional case.
Yeah.
It also comes into play there. I mean, it's a very important tool. So in the next... So if you didn't understand this, which I know may be a little bit... complicated, especially for the student who had never seen scattering before. It will be completely different topic. So if you are lost here, there is some hope from the next time. I taught a whole course on scattering, where I did in painful detail all these expansions, the Hankel functions, and all these things. So if anybody wants to copy a proof of Rayleigh's lemma, if anybody wants to copy it, it's very welcome. I have to say, my preference...
We'll make copies and we'll force Froze to teach us a course on scaling from Mexico.
Well, it takes a long time to actually do it in full detail. If you want to do it in full detail, I mean, it takes a while.
Our students are hard workers. Uh-huh. They can do this exercise.
Why are you looking at me?
I have to say, though, that I prefer personally the time dependent. This is a stationary approach. There are many approaches to scattering. This is not the only one. It's more natural, in fact, to take a time dependent approach, in my opinion. Which you take waves, real waves, you know, these are the. And take the time evolution. But for the fixed energy problems, because you're fixing the energy, this is much more natural. You want to consider some other problems, for instance, the backscattering. We measure for all energies, but you measure the reflection. So you send your waves, and you measure the reflection back. This is what they do in remote sensing in satellites, right? Scattering is remote sensing, right? You send your wave from very far away, and you measure the reflection. And this is exactly what they do. And there, you are measuring for all frequencies, but the angle is the reflected angle. So you're measuring the echo. Can you recover the potential? By the way, this is actually an unsolved problem. A lot is known, but it's an unsolved problem because the number of variables here is exactly right. It's one dimension, and n minus one is n dimension. You're trying to recover a function of n dimensions. A lot is known, but still not completely solved. There is more natural, in my opinion. I mean, many people have different opinions, but to take the time-dependent approach, you send a wave, and then you measure the reflection back, because then you have all frequencies.
Motorola will pay money for this problem?
Huh?
Motorola will pay money for this.
or remote sensing. You solve the backscattering problem, then yeah, I guess. But they are interested in a code. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, you have to develop. You talk to any of the people who are interested in practical applications, you know, they don't care about the theorem here. They want to see what is your code, right? If it produces better images than the ones they have, then you will be a rich man. But there is a lot between, you know, doing this theory and doing the numerical. This is another very important aspect, the numerical. Why? Because you only make finite number of measurements. Mm-hmm. What approximation can you get? There's a lot of work in there, and then you have to code all of these things, and there's also another major work. So this should involve many people in different fields. So let's take a break. I'm sorry about. Now I'm going to talk about a completely different inverse problem, which does not involve any PDEs at all. So maybe if it has for you. it actually involves geometry. You know, inverse problems are related to many subjects in mathematics and applications. So this is very much related to differential geometry. So, as I said yesterday, the motivation comes from geophysics, though. So you look at the travel times of seismic waves that penetrate the Earth's interior. So as I said yesterday, the sources for earthquakes the sources for seismic waves are earthquakes. There are a lot of earthquakes all over the time. They are recorded, and the travel times are measured. And more information is actually measured, as I'm going to mention later. And from this, we want to recover the inner structure of the Earth. So this is, of course, a very ambitious goal, but some progress has been made, and actually it's a very important problem in geophysics. Okay, so the way that travel times are modeled is the following. You take a metric, and this is the isotropic case. So dx squared is a standard metric in Euclidean space, which is just a multiple of the standard metric. Yes. So you measure length. This is to measure length. Just a multiple at every point. Of the and C is assumed to be a positive function. Okay, so this is the isotropic case in which. And C represents the sound speed of the waves. We're going to are looking at the wave equation model. I mean, it's more natural to consider the elastic model, but this is a simpler case, or index of refraction. And the Earth is very heterogeneous, so you have to make it dependent on X. And the anisotropic case and actually recently has been discovered, there's an article in Science recently by Kriegers giving evidence that the inner core of the Earth is anisotropic. I mean, they have all by measuring travel times. It doesn't correspond to isotropic situations. What you do is you measure length differently in different directions. So Gij is a positive definite symmetric matrix. Familiar object coming from the conductivity. And from the geometric point of view, this is called a Riemannian metric. So here, you see, if you go, depending on what direction you go, the length is weighted differently. You know, in the I direction and J direction is weighted differently. Here it's weighted the same. In every direction it's the same. So this is one particular case of that, of course, a formal case. So what do I mean by, what I got to measure, what I mean by travel time? So let me define it in general. Suppose you take any domain in Euclidean space, as before bounded with smooth boundary. I take G again, the remaining metric, positive definite symmetric matrix, as before. Then the length, what I'm going to measure, is the length which is the infimum. So x and y will be 2 points in the boundary. So this is going to be x and y in the boundary. I'm going to measure the length in with respect to this metric, which is defined as the infimum. We take all the curves going from x to y. And you say from at time, this is at time one, and you measure the length of this curve with respect to the metric. So the infimum with respect to the curves. You take all the curves going from here to here, and you take the minimum, the infimum of that. This is very much related to, remember, the infimum of this quadratic form that we had previously for solutions. I'm going to make a comparison at the end of both things. So this is what we're going to measure. So measure dg of xy for all xy in the boundary. Question: can we recover G? G in omega. Okay. And in the isotropic case, can we recover the sound speed? That's the problem. And, well, the answer is no. For the anisotropic case,
you just measure the length of the
GDT? Right. But the minimizing geodesics, see, this is the, because I'm taking the infimum, yeah. Right? I'm going to make this point in a moment. Yeah, so those are exactly the lengths of geodesics, right?
Are you really measuring the travel time rather than is it a length?
Well, that's a good question. I only measure the travel time. This is just a measure of the travel time of the minimizing geodesic, if there is one. Not all the travel time. So I will come back to that, actually, because it's an important point later on. This is the first one that's going to be measured, right? The minimizing one, the one that goes fastest from one point to the other, that's the one you're going to be measuring first. The answer is no, in general. If you take a change of variables, so a diffeomorphism, which is the identity of the boundary, so it fixes the boundary, then the following was called the pullback, which is defined to be the differential of size transpose composed with G, composed with differential of size, composed with psi inverse of X, that gives the same distance function. That's why. Let me explain why. this, what does it mean first this? This is a matrix. This is a matrix. The differential of psi is a matrix. This is a matrix. I'm looking at this as a composition of matrices. Where does this comes from? You look at this, the definition, you look at the curve, you take the original curve and you compose with the diffeomorphism, psi. Take a new curve, take this change variables in this gamma, and now change here using the chain rule. You apply the chain rule, and you will see that this expression, since the points x and y are fixed by this because the diffeomorphism is the identity at the boundary, you're going to see that this remains invariant. It's exactly the same. Actually, this is completely clear to geometers because this is just the pullback of the metric. So there is this obstruction. In the isotropic case, there's no obstruction. Is suppose G is isotropic. And this is a hard exercise. Actually, what I'm going to... I'm leaving a lot of hard problems. Suppose you take a diffeomorphism, a change of variables, which is the identity of the boundary. Suppose the pullback of this metric is another one. So an isotropic is also isotropic. It's one alpha of x, the square where alpha is positive. So suppose for some reason the pullback of an isotropic metric is also isotropic, right? Which is, see here, it's not going to be true in general. Even if this is isotropic, that this is going to be isotropic because this is a differential of psi, it's a full matrix, it's not diagonal. But if it happens to be diagonal, then, and its identity at the boundary implies the psi's identity. This is a theorem of Nipper. Nipper? In the 40s. In the annals, actually. It was an important result at the time. So it's a nonlinear PDE that you have here, and this is the identity at the boundary, therefore has to be the identity altogether. So I'll leave this as an exercise. Okay. So in the isotropic case, there is no obstruction. But in the anisotropic case, there is an obstruction. So the question is that the only obstruction? Is this only obstruction? That's a big open problem. But unless you assume something more, the answer is still no.
What do you mean the only obstruction?
This diffeomorphism. It's in other words, so let me be more specific. Suppose you have two metrics, G, G tilde, Riemannian matrix. So this is the anisotropic case that have the same distance function. Does there exist a diffeomorphism, a change of variables, which is the identity at the boundary, so that G tilde is the pullback of G? That's what it means. And this is actually a problem of a lot of interest in Riemannian geometry. It's called the boundary rigidity problem. I mean, this is independent of the motivation from geophysics, but the differential geometers have been considered this problem for completely different reasons. In fact, a lot of the results are due to geometers for the anisotropic case. But still the answer is no. Let me give you an example that can be done in the isotropic or the anisotropic case. It doesn't really matter. Suppose you have in a point inside and a region of very low velocity. So let's take the isotropic case. And then I'm going to perturb it a little bit around. That means the metric is very high. That's why remember the metric is 1 over the velocity. Suppose you have a big bump. That means this distance to the boundary is larger than the suprema of the distances for 2 points xy in the boundary. Okay? So here it can be Euclidean, for instance. Then you're not going to see it. You can change your metric a little bit here. As you wish. You can change it any way you want here, and there's no way you're going to see it here because this is too far from the boundary. So this corresponds to a region of low velocity. Okay, very low velocity inside. Okay. Let me give you another example of appearance in geometry. You can consider the problems for manifolds, not just for domains in Euclidean space. I like this problem because this is the Earth again, and I like to put, being the only person from the southern hemisphere here, I put the South Pole up. It's really annoying, you know, to always study, when you are in Chile, you study maps and everything else, you know, with everything.
It's above you.
Uh-huh. Everything above you. Why, right? Why? Suppose you are you're in the sphere here. This is not a problem in Euclidean space, right? But you can flatten it if you want. But let me consider, the problem can be considered manifold. So the boundary here is the equator. So consider this sphere. Is you have the standard metric here. To go from here to here, you go along the equator. Right? Unless you want to get frequent flyer miles, Nassif will do this. We'll go to the South Pole, to Chile, right? Take a geodesic. Go from here through the South Pole. Right? That's too long. So the problem is, you're not going to see anything that happens near the South Pole. You can change the metric. Without changing the boundary distance function. And here comes the question you ask, because what is happening here is I'm only taking into account the minimizing geodesic and not all the geodesics. Right? I'm only taking this travel time and not all the travel time. The other one takes longer. Well, it depends on your means of transportation, but
still a geodesic.
And you should take that into account. Right? So comes the following question. That is the first problem. Is dg, can we recover g? dg, can we recover g from this distance function? It's not true, not only because of this obstruction that we had before, which is the natural obstruction, but unless some restrictions are imposed on the metric on G, right? But we should take into account, I'm going to propose another problem. Take into account all the geodesics. All geodesics. Not just minimizing ones. And one way to encode let me tell you a way to encode that information of all the geodesics. How would you do that? What you do is the following. You have your point in the boundary, x, and you take the direction of the geodesic. See, every geodesic has a direction as well, so that's what we're going to. I'm going to go this way instead of this way. So C is the direction of the geodesic, say, has norm 1, and it goes inside. So what I'm going to do is follow this geodesic and look at where it exits and the direction that it exits. So this is the direction of entrance. This is the y is the point of exit and the direction of exit. Of the geodesic. Because geodesics are determined by points and the direction. So also with length 1 with respect to the metric. So a way to encode the information is I'm going to be given the travel time as before, but I'm going to add information. This CG, this is in analogy with the Scotchy data that I defined before, because I think they are very related. And CG will consist of the point and the direction of entrance. I will know the point and direction of entrance and the point of the direction of exit. So this is x and y are points in the boundary. C is direction of entrance. Eta, direction of exit. So C and eta, of course, are unit vectors. So I know the direction that comes in and the point where it comes in, and I will know where it goes out and the direction it goes out. So I'm going to take this is going to be my information. So the inverse problem, this is the good news for the students here. Suppose you have DG plus CG, both. Suppose I give you both information now. And by the way, this is measured in practice. The direction of arrival of waves is measured in practice. Thus, this implies we can recover G up to the natural obstruction, because it's always this, the change of variables is always going to be present, but you're going to fix your system of coordinates, and so it should be okay, up to change of variables. So I will tell you almost everything that's known about 1 and 2. 2 is easy. Nothing.
DG is minimizing.
It's minimizing. Yes.
So you want to know. But you want to know anything about the other geodesics.
But I'm assuming that I will know all this information. I know the point and direction of entrance. And I know the point and direction of exit. So these are the...
Oh, so minimal geodesic.
No, every geodesic.
Oh, every
geodesic.
Oh, okay.
Not just the minimizing ones.
Oh,
no, for the minimizing one, I already know it. That's the DG.
Yeah.
But I'm taking all the geodesics now. So here, in this part... So in the particular two examples that I have here...
What's the DG here?
Plus, I'm adding. Plus. I'm adding this information.
You don't have the times for the non-minimizing ones, but you know where they exit from.
And the direction that they exit. Let me give you an example here. The first example that I gave. This one. You know, the minimizing geodesic from going to one point to another, the boundary is going to avoid this high velocity in the middle, going to go around, because this is too high, right? I'm going to try to minimize the time of arrival. However, there will be some geodesics that will come through here. It will take a long time for them to come to the boundary, but if you are patient, they will come, and then you measure the information that you're given. So, CG, by the way, is called the scattering relation. It's a relation, and now, and it's nothing is known about two. So I said I will give you most of the results, all the results. So this is no results. So anything that you do is a breakthrough. It's not known the following. It's not known even the following. It's not an easy problem. It's easy to state, but this is one of the... Take the Euclidean metric. So these are straight lines. Your decimals are just straight lines. Suppose you have a metric that has the same scattering relation as the Euclidean metric. And the same distance function. Is it the Euclidean metric up to isometry, up to change of variable? But even that is not known, in general. I mean, you don't assume any other condition. I will tell you an approach that we have to this problem in a moment. We have an approach to this problem that gave new results for problem one, but not for the original purpose, which was problem two, which is typical in math, right? You try to solve a problem, you finish solving some other problem. So let me tell you very quickly what's known about problem one in general. As I said before, you have to assume more conditions. Otherwise, it's not true, right? The standard condition that is, and this is done for manifolds, the geometers consider general manifolds with boundary, is this is what's called simple. So that means given, that is, given 2 points, x, y, on the boundary, there exists unique minimizing geodesic joining x and y. So this avoids all these problems here or the hemisphere because there are many geodesics going through the south pole. And moreover, the boundary is strictly convex with respect to the metric. So the conjecture for problem one, so this is a lot of conditions, a priori conditions, which are not satisfied in practice, certainly not in the Earth. By the way, so the conjecture, before I say, is if omega g is simple, then dg determines g up to a change of variable. By the way, in the result of Herklotz that I mentioned yesterday, that was the first one that I know of that look at this problem from the geophysics point of view, he considered the case of a spherically symmetric Earth. And as I said yesterday, he has explicit formulas to recover the C from the length, from the travel time, from the dg. But he assumed the condition. Remember, I said this. He did it under the condition that this is an increasing function of the radius. So that means there are no regions of low velocity inside. This implies that in the Earth, omega g is simple. So he was looking really at simple metrics already in that case. And for this, some results are known in the case of constant curvature. So let me mention the final results. There are many people. Well, the first one who really proposed this problem in differential geometry was René Michel, who considered the case of simple. Simple means satisfying this condition here, subdomains of R2, the hyperbolic to plane and the hemisphere. It had to be simple, though. Gromov, and this is not a simple result, but consider simple subdomains of any Euclidean space in any dimension. And recently, the sun. Simple subdomains. So this is the result, for instance, if the distance function is the same as the distance of the Euclidean metric, then it must be Euclidean, up to change of variables. But you have to assume a priori this condition. Besson, Courtois, and Gallo recently, part of a more general thing actually, they did the case simple subdomains of any symmetric space, in particular the hyperbolic space in any dimension. Or negative curvature, sorry. Of symmetric spaces or negative curvature. But these are.
Approach of this entropy.
Entropy, that's exactly right. The entropy, so, very beautiful.
By the way, for the students, we are planning to have a working group with Elana Fraser and Jingyi to study these papers.
Oh, this is a beautiful result. As a consequence, This is a consequence of their result is exactly this. For any, not just HN, but any symmetric space, it's a beautiful, very powerful.
It's a breakthrough in geometry,
Based
on very basic ideas from analysis, entropy.
Right. It's an isoperimetric type of inequality with the entropy.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Maybe in general, you have
working with. Yeah, this is a very beautiful paper.
Elana, Fraser, Jingyi, and I, so far, everybody can join.
You know, these problems are.
Copy the paper.
Right. That this is a case of negative curvature. And in two dimensions, these are all constant curvature spaces. The curvature is constant in all of these spaces. The only result I know of a general result with a variable curvature is the Gaussian curvature is negative in dimension 2. This is a result of Krog and the independent Othal. But the case of positive curvature, even a small little bit of positive curvature is completely open. Particularly there you have the problem that rays focus. You see, in negative curvature, geodesic spread. Okay, so let me tell you, this is essentially most of what's known. I mean, there are other little results, but I will tell you about an approach we had to problem two very quickly. I don't have much time. So approach. And this is joint work with this with Plum and Stefano. And I have the paper here for anybody who wants to look at, which is to problem two. So this means I want to look at the scattering relation plus DG. So remember, the scattering relation is you look at the point and the direction, and you look at the point of exit and the direction of exit. That's what we're looking at. So it's very natural to consider this problem in phase space. That information is given in phase space, points and directions and points and directions. So I'm going to consider the problem in phase space. And I look at the Hamiltonian. Phase space means points and directions. The Hamiltonian associated to the metric. By the way, if you don't know the definition of geodesics, this is a good way to define geodesics. So I look at the points. Hg equal to 0 is the sphere, the unit sphere in the metric. Gij is the inverse. So this is the natural Hamiltonian actually associated to a metric. You go to the cotangent space. So we're going to look at points and directions in phase space. So three dimensions, we're looking at six dimensional space. And you look at the bi-characteristics. Of the Hamiltonian vector field. So the Hamiltonian vector field is defined this. This is a vector field in phase space. So it's a vector in six dimensions and you are in three-dimensional space. Okay, I'm not going to write it down, you just differentiate. And I look at the integral curves. The integral curves of this Hamiltonian vector field, those are the bicharacteristics. So I'm going to take arc length usually for right? By the way, these are the geodesics. If you project the bicharacteristics down into the Euclidean space, these are geodesics. This is another way, in fact, Hamilton's way of looking at geodesics. You don't need to take Stoffel symbols and solving the. This is, you can define the Hamiltonian, and this is a way to look at. I prefer this way personally.
There's a class.
Yes, I'm going to finish very quickly. I'm sorry. As we started late, so I'm going to call xg of sx0 the bicharacteristic with initial condition x0, c0. So at 0 and c0, c0. Okay? So what we are proposing is the following. You know, so the inverse problem is, you know, xg of t x0 when t is the distance function. Right? So x0 is initial. This is for every x0. So x0 is initial point. You follow it. You follow the bicharacteristic until it exits. You know the point where it exits and the direction of exits at the time t that takes to get from here to here. Right? So it's an ODE. You know the solution of an ODE for this time. Can we recover the metric? Okay, and I don't have time to explain this, but we derive an integral identity similar to the integration by parts for this, which says, I want to finish very quickly. You have two metrics with the same distance function and the same scattering relation, so they have the same solution of the ODE. Then apply to BG1 minus BG2, XG2 of SX0, DS is 0. So you integrate along the bicharacteristics, the difference of the Hamiltonian vector fields, and this is a matrix, the fundamental matrix associated to this ODE. And with this, we prove the following result. If G1 is close to the Euclidean metric and G2 is simple and the distance function is the same, this implies G1 is equal to G2 up to change of variable. So you need one metric to be close to the Euclidean metric, the other one arbitrary but simple. That's what I said. This leads to a new result for the first problem, not the original problem. Why? Because we needed to solve this integral equation. This is linear in G1 inverse minus G2 inverse, the Hamiltonian. This corresponds to the identity that we have before Q1 minus Q2, U1, U2 equal to 0. This is linear in this part. This is non-linear. This is linear. This is geodesic flow, the bicharacteristic flow. So why can we do this only for the Euclidean metric? Because we don't know how to invert this transform in general. However, at the Euclidean metric, this is integration along lines. This is just a standard X-ray transform that you talk about the first class, I think. So you perturb near that, you can also invert. So the question is, this is true in general. Can we invert this transform in general to conclude that these two metrics are the same? So this is a new approach to this, this new analytic approach to this geometric question, but has led so far only to result for the first problem, because still have to assume that the metrics are simple, because otherwise I don't know how to invert this identity. Okay, sorry.
What you do for Dirichlet and for Schrödinger equation versus also for Hamiltonian system?
Our motivation to get this was exactly the Dirichlet-Neumann map, what
so
we did for.
Natural extension to the Hamiltonian.
Exactly. And it's very natural to consider for more general Hamiltonian system the same inverse problem. Suppose you have a Hamiltonian.
To get the Hamiltonian.
Exactly. Can you get the Hamiltonian from.
It's much harder.
This is a very particular one.
Even for Dirichlet, you're doing it really for most basic linear equation.
Exactly.
You're not doing it for.
Right. For a general, any general
PDE, yeah.
Yeah. But look at this very simple Hamiltonian.
Oh no, this is beautiful stuff.
I went very fast at the end. I can talk more about this. This is what I'm working on nowadays, so I really like this problem. So I can talk more detail about this.
You will come back in November, later in November. We want an encore.
Okay.
We can discuss it.
Okay.
No,
that was fast at the end.